This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Ha ha ha, maybe we'll leave this to the professional.
This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Number one retro gaming podcast. This is Retro Asylum, episode 45 and a half. This is the first in a week-long series of podcasts. We've got a podcast every single day. Some are a little bit shorter than others. Some are like the normal length ones. So obviously being 46 tomorrow, we should have a longer length podcast. And we got a right old feast of information and discussions coming up for you. Got Foggy and Simon are going to be doing a podcast. You've got Glenn, he's doing one on his own. That's about PC gaming. Andy's obviously going to do one on his own. And Andy and Glenn are getting together as well. And there is more to come. Well, just more than that as well. But that is what we've got coming up for this whole week. Why are we doing a week's worth of podcasts? Well, end of the day, why the hell not? It's just a bit of fun, really. It's just a bit of fun. Get even more content out to you and more great chat. At least I hope it's going to be great chat. I'm sure this podcast is going to be somewhere in the region of interesting. And what am I going to talk about in this podcast? I'll come on to that in just a moment. But first of all, we'll talk about the usual kind of thing. What have I been up to? So this is just me on this podcast, Matt Dinaris, as I haven't mentioned so far. What I've been up to? I've been moving house. I sold my flat after a very, very long time on the market. And that was a very long, drawn out and stressful process. Currently living at the in-laws and when you're listening to this podcast, I shall be moving in to our new home with my good lady. Finally got a house together and finally going to be living in holy matrimony, as they like to say. And looking for places to have a little setup for my music and retro gaming and that, and because there's two decent sized bedrooms in that house, I'm sure I'll be able to fashion something. It's a loft and a shed, so there's plenty of scope there, I think. But that is mainly what I've been up to. Haven't had a lot of chance to do any gaming other than took a week off work to do all the packing for the move. Jesus, it was unbelievable how much stuff I've got. I'm really quite overwhelmed with the amount of just stuff that isn't really... It's hard to throw it away. I'm a hoarder, I think. Not a major hoarder. I'm not one of these obsessive compulsive hoarders that has got house full of crap. Nothing on those lines, because when my flat was on the market, essentially it was immaculate. It was like a show house pretty much all the time. But in the cupboards, there weren't that many cupboards, but my God, I filled some boxes. And I've got loads of records because I used to be a DJ. That took up a fair amount of boxes. But that was really, really easy to pack because they're all square. They all fit into boxes. They're bloody heavy. But it was very, very easy to do that. But it was all the other stuff, you know, old computer magazines, old computers, joysticks, cables and leads and music equipment. And oh, my word, it just went on and on and on. But I managed to pack it all and it was incredibly stressful to the point of almost snapping on the last day. I was particularly not a pleasant person on that day, but I did it. But what I found, I've got something like 6 or 7 Commodore 64s in various states of repair and loads of tape decks and a disk drive and all that kind of stuff. And sort of 5 or 6 Amigas as well. And just wondering why on earth I had three PlayStation 1s. Now, I think I've mentioned it before, I'm not particularly a PlayStation 1 fan. So not really sure why I got three of them. So I gave one away to a mate at work who wanted one. Kept one, which was the audiophile type one that I mentioned on a previous podcast, and I've got another one that's just going to sit around kicking its heels, and I might bring that down to Retromania and give it away as some kind of prize or, I don't know, raffle. I don't know what we'll do down there, but I might even bring an Amiga and a Commodore 64 along. I can't bother to sell them on eBay because they might get broken in the post. I've had a lot of bad luck on eBay in recent times in that respect. So I think I'm just going to give them away for a pittance. We'll see. But I need to get them out of storage and have a look at them. I've decided, because I am this hoarder of stuff, thinking, you know, I've got all these Commodore 64s. Take the Commodore 64s, for example. Like I said, six or seven of them, I can't really remember now, all in various states of disrepair. I've been thinking I'm going to keep them for the SID chips. Okay, that's fine. One might not work at all, but I'll keep that because it might have a component in it that I can use somewhere else. And that's all well and good if you have the space and the time and the inclination to do repairs. And in all reality, Damien's great at these repairs and he's going to show off his skills down at Retromania. If you don't know what Retromania is, I'll come on to that in just a moment. I'm not skilled at repairs of this kind of thing, so I'm... Am I ever going to get round to it? I'd love to. I would genuinely love to get into electronics and soldering and making stuff and repairing stuff. But in reality, time is not on anyone's side, including mine. So I don't think it's going to happen. So I might just consolidate and get rid of. But I say that now when I look at them in their boxes and think, oh, no, you look lovely in there. You look really nice. I'm not going to get rid of you. So we'll see. And when it comes to Commodore 64 as well, I've still got this Commodore 64 SID synth to build, which takes two SID chips. So, in essence, who's going to buy a Commodore 64 without a SID chip in it? I don't know. Probably someone would, but we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see. So that's what I've been doing anyway. But like I said, in between of all that, all the packing, I've found my Commodore 60 or the C64 DTV. Now, this was a joystick Commodore 64 developed by Jerry Ellsworth. If you don't know Jerry Ellsworth, Google her. She's probably most geeks' wet dream, in all honesty. She developed a Commodore 64 on a chip. It's emulation on a chip. There's no two ways about it. And the emulation isn't perfect. But this is a joystick model of the Competition Pro that has 30, I think it's 30 games built in. And they're all pretty deep. Well, not all of them, but a good chunk of them, 78% of them, are really good. Clearly some kind of deal done with Epix and Houston, and maybe one other company. There's a lot of some Andy Braybrook games in there, a lot of other Houston games like Zara Thruster, Cybernoid. Then there's California Games from Epix, another one from Epix, which is just quite poor in my opinion. But it's a really good, it's got a lovely front end, which is coded in Commodore 64 machine language. Great SID tune on that, and it's just a selector for games. Select your game and play it. You've got a nice, reasonable feeling joystick, and you plug into a TV via composite output input. It's the, you know, it's the one yellow lead and one white lead for the audio. One with yellow for the video. And that kept me going. When I had 5-10 minutes spare, I'd plug it in, play Cybernoid, play, I think it was Exelon, Alley Cat, that was it. Alley Cat by Andy Braybrook, which was a really interesting shoot 'em up. I think it came after Iridium. Same kind of sound effects as Iridium and Paradroid. Really interesting shoot 'em up. Take a look at that on YouTube. It's frustrating as hell, but it's really interesting. You can... It's overhead. It's an overhead vertical scrolling shooter, but you can raise and lower your ship on the space deck. And it's got different kind of levels. The levels are could be a race, could be a slalom through checkpoints while you're shooting stuff as well. Really quite interesting. I'm glad I found the DTV and glad I found some of the games on the. Only problem is it takes batteries and they run out. Well, I've been using a mishmash of AA batteries, so I really need to just invest in a good set of four and play it, and it exerts some really weird things when the batteries start running out. Some of the symptoms are just keeps resetting itself, and I thought I'd messed it. I nearly said the F word there. I thought I'd messed it up when it just kept on resetting itself, and I couldn't get it to load. I couldn't get it to get to the menu screen that you select your game on. And I wonder what I'd done to it. I thought I'd ruined it because I was sort of trying to work out what the buttons did on the joysticks. It's got six buttons on it. In the end, it turned out to be batteries, so I just needed to change the batteries, voila, it's working again. But like I say, really glad I found it. Interesting story at the time, not so interesting now, was I got bought it for Christmas by, I think it was my brother, and also my best mate bought me one, and I didn't have the heart to tell him. If he's listening to this, I'm sorry about that, mate. I didn't have the heart to tell him at the time that I'd already got one, but it's turned out quite nice. I've now got a mint boxed one, which is so, you know, small. It's a joystick case, essentially. I'm going to keep it because it's really good. If one dies, then I've got the other one. If not, I've got a mint one for forevermore. Seek these out. You can still pick them up for less than 15 quid on eBay. If you want a Commodore 64 with a quick lot of games in it that runs a decent emulation and it's got proper, you know, it's 50 frames per second, etc., etc., and it's hackable. It's hackable. You can add a keyboard, you can add more joystick ports, you can add, I think, tape or disc ports as well. I mean, it requires some soldering, it requires a bit of, you know, tech geekery, should we say, with some circuit bending. But it's all there. It's really hackable. There's websites dedicated to it. But all in all, it's just a really pick-up-able, usable Commodore 64 with some games in it. Get onto eBay, chuck a search in C64DTV and check it out. There's some demos that come out for it as well, and I believe its native graphical display is actually better than the Commodore 64. I think it's got 256 colours and maybe a slightly higher resolution, because some of these demos have taken advantage of that, which is a really interesting little part of the unit. I've digressed long and hard away from the topic of this podcast, which I shall come on to now, because I don't want to ramble on any more about what I've been up to. Piracy, as I said right at the start, piracy is one of the subjects which has been a little bit taboo over the years. There's been articles in magazines about it, and they might have, you know, delved into the truth somewhat, but maybe not have spoken their mind quite like they would have or could have done, because obviously, they didn't want to upset the games companies and the industry too much. It's typical of the magazine world. It's typical of any press publication. They will sort of err on the side of caution unless it is a typically controversial magazine. But piracy, like I say, it's. I'm going to speak the truth the way I perceive it. This is not necessarily the truth of the way it is. This is just the way I've perceived piracy and the way I think it's affected the industry and the way I think it's benefited the industry as well. This might come out sounding a little bit pro-piracy. I hope not. I'm certainly not suggesting that, but I think there is some benefits that piracy has given to us as gamers over the years. Obviously free games, but we'll come on to that. You know, piracy and its origins. I've tried to research where it all started. Now, I got a feeling that it started with maybe swap meets or computer get-togethers, not computer parties so much, but like user groups and such like in the, I guess, 70s and 80s. And, you know, piracy goes back way into whenever there's stuff to buy, there's going to be copies or clones or piracy of it, isn't there? You know, music being the big one, films being another big one. Right back in history, whenever there's been films, there's been pirate films around in some way, shape or form. You know, even the clothing markets, you've got piracy in clothing markets, you've got clones, you've got copies, you've got fakes, rip-offs. They're essentially pirate versions of the real thing. So, but when it comes to gaming and computer piracy, where it started, like I said, these swap meets, computer fairs, copy pies, it says it all. It really come to the masses when, say, the ZX80, 81 and the Spectrum, certainly Spectrum and Commodore 64, the first mass market gaming machines. Okay, they could do a lot more, but they're the first mass market gaming machines. And what did their software come on initially? It was tape. Well, tape, how easy is that to copy? How easy was it to copy back then? right, we may not have had sophisticated Nakamichi tape decks as kids and so on, but we'd have had some way to copy those tapes. And by the very nature of having a Spectrum, you'd have to have a portable tape deck with what we called at the time mic leads, which were essentially audio leads, audio with the mini jack connectors on them. If you had another tape deck, reverse the connectors the other end, Bosch, you're in, and you've got a way to tape those games. So tape was really easy to copy, and that's where it basically blew up. That's where piracy started and blew up and become the big behemoth that it is and the big controversial subject that it is. Why was there piracy? Of course, because it's about getting free stuff. We all want free stuff. Yeah, piracy is around to this day because we all want free stuff. I went through school, like probably you did. I'd hope you did. I've worked for the whole of my life, and everyone I've come into contact with that has had a computer or a console of some sort has copied games, has pirated games. They've bought games as well, don't get me wrong, but they've pirated. I've never known a single person I've come into contact with, dare I say, a few hundred people that have played games in their time. Maybe not quite that much, but a good 100 people I've known over the years who've played games, had computers, had consoles. Not a single one of them has been solely about original games, buying games from the shop completely. But I would say every single one of them did buy games, just they pirated as well. And I hold my hands up to that. Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to come knocking on my door just yet. I've pirated games, you know, come and shoot me and wrap me up and chuck me down the drain for it. I don't think I'd be lying to think anyone listening to this podcast has pirated as well. But piracy was so easy because of the tape stuff that it happened. And at these early copy parties and swap meets and computer fairs, because there was no copy protection, either in the game or on the tape, then they were just copying games and spreading them around. And, you know, when you're young as well, when you're young and into this kind of thing, I got my first computer, I don't know, when I was like 6 or 7 maybe. There was computers in the family before that, but maybe 6 or 7. I probably didn't know what piracy was. I just kept getting these free games from people. Well, shall I mention names here? Someone I know would often come back to the house with their copied games for the Spectrum on a near daily basis. And that person would have gotten from their friends and so on. Just a big, I guess, playground culture. You know, that person was at school and there's the playground culture. And that was so exciting, getting up every morning and thinking, oh, I might have a new game today. Or certainly 2 or 3 times a week, there would be a new game coming about. And it was exciting. It was genuinely exciting to get up the next morning and think, I've got a game to play. So you play it a little bit before school, because in those days, mornings were so long. Days were so long as well. You know, the time seems to fly these days. You could get up before school and play a game. Now I couldn't even imagine doing anything of the sort. Just getting up is about being as grumpy as possible, getting ready for work and sort of rolling into work, trying to look half awake. Back in those days, it was nothing of the sort. Then you get home from school and you'd be really excited to play those games as well. So it was a whole different world back then. But tape piracy was very, very easy. Disc piracy, on the other hand, might have had copy protection on the discs. I'm not sure whether the Commodore 64 games and, you know, even something like Micro Drive games on the Spectrum, which I'm going to class as a disc, even though it really wasn't a disc. Not sure whether they had copy protection embedded onto the disc at all. But because tape piracy is so easy, the industry responded by having things like the lens lock, if you remember the lens lock. Fantastic little device. It was essentially a bit of plastic with a bit of perspex, a clear perspex, which had a pattern formed into it. So it was loads of different bits of perspex joined together. And by moulding that into like a bridge shape, so like an inverted C shape, you could bend it into that shape. You'd put it over the screen, and on the screen was an image that was encoded. The lens lock would essentially decode it, scrambled, right, and the lens lock would decode that scramble in some way. Great idea in theory, but because everyone's TV differed, be it, I mean, we always have the vertical hole problem. I don't know whether you remember that, where the screen would bounce up and down, and, you know, bigger screens. How would this lens lock work on a bigger screen? It probably didn't. worked fine for me because of a 40. I think we stuck with 14-inch TVs throughout most of our gaming careers. But if you had a big TV, this lens lock was a nightmare to use. But then there was the other ones of picking words out of manuals or these sort of crib sheets, matrixes with words on them, rows and columns of words, where the game would say, what is in column F, row 20? And you'd look down and you go, oh, that's A, B, C, D. But they made these on paper with, I don't know, real dark red paper with black writing, so it was really hard to photocopy. But that didn't stop people writing those tables out, a bit laborious, and then just photocopying up those tables for mates and so on. So piracy was very, very easy in those days. And when it wasn't easy, you had the job role of a cracker. So crackers, whole scene come up around hacking and cracking. And I don't know how early this started. It's probably very, very early on, 82, 83 maybe, on the Commodore 64 and possibly on the Spectrum. I'm not too sure. I wasn't that close to the Spectrum as I was the Commodore 64. And people would essentially crack this copy protection, be it a manual protection or disk-based protection, and put a little note at the start saying this game was cracked by so-and-so. Didn't happen on tapes. It was more on disk-based games. But they removed the copy protection out of it. I never had a tape-based game that was cracked. So I might be wrong in saying that there wasn't one, but I never had one. Disc base, absolutely, cracking all the time. So that was why piracy was, and still is this day, fairly easy, really. Well, I'll talk a little bit about the modern-day piracy, but, you know, where there was a copy protection, it was generally broken and cracked and taken away so anyone could copy it. So, and then this piracy just spread out worldwide. People copied games worldwide. And how did people get these games? Well, playground culture was probably one of the biggest ways of doing it. You went to school, your mates had a Spectrum, your mates had a Commodore, your mates had an Amstrad or a VIC-20 or whatever, and you'd copy the games between you, and that spread out throughout that school. And, you know, maybe you'd go home and your brother would then take it to his school. Your sister might take it to their school and copy it there and about. So piracy spread and spread and spread, and this clearly had an impact on the industry. Cartridge piracy, when the console started coming out, was a lot harder. There was no easy way to do it. Clone consoles was one of them. There was a lot of clone consoles, and I believe the NES is one of the biggest clone consoles out there. And there was add-ons for certainly the SNES. Don't know whether the Mega Drive had it. Actual floppy disk add-ons that the pirates or manufacturers developed to allow you to copy games onto disk and so on. So real ingenious ways of copying. However, console piracy was a lot harder. There's no doubt about it. The consoles were pretty... Your average kid in the playground couldn't get a copy of a console game. You might have got one of these multi-carts where you'd have more than one game on a cartridge. That's essentially a form of piracy. But it was all about the home computers. The home computers, it was very, very easy to crack games or copy them without any copy protection on them. So that's where piracy started and how it spread around and so on. Coming back onto this concept of cracking games, that's how the demo scene was born. I'm not going to go too much into the demo scene now because I do have a podcast coming up later on in the year about the demo scene. Look it up, have a little Google around about it. But the demo scene may not have existed if it wasn't for the cracking scene, for the hacking scene, for this piracy, big amount of piracy. Because when a game was cracked and had the copy protection removed, the crackers would inevitably put a little message at the beginning, be it a very tiny pop-up message or just text on the basic screen of Commodore 64 saying, cracked by Bob Bandit of Balance. Okay, yeah, I'm reading off a sheet of paper. I don't know where I got Bob Balance from, but anyway, Bob Bandit even. Anyway, I digress. It would say cracked by so-and-so of so-and-so group. You know, there would be a message there. And often these messages might go into greetings to other cracking groups or crackers. Because in the beginning there was just crackers, and then eventually there was groups that would crack games. And cracking was all about getting the games out as quickly as possible, getting rid of that copy protection and getting it out as quickly as possible. These messages built into bigger things. So there would be maybe a coded effect before the game, which might be a scrolling message or it might be a 3D twisting shape. I'm talking a bit later on in the cracking world, but in the early days, you know, it's probably just a scrolling text or just a fancy visual effect there saying cracked by Bob Bandit of Balance. We'll keep using him as an example. And greetings out to these groups, and you know, the rest of you are lame, you can't crack games to save your life. There was always some kind of elite message in there. You know, crackers strive to be the best in their industry, I guess. That's one way to look at it. If you liken the cracking world to an industry, like the games industry, crackers, just like coders, want it to be the best, or want it to be the quickest to crack a game, or the best at cracking a certain type of copy protection. So there was a lot of, you know, competitiveness in this world. But what these spawned, what this cracking scene spawned, was the concept of intros, which were, like I say, coded graphical effects, maybe with a bit of music in the background as well, and a message on it saying, okay, Creatures by Apex Computers, cracked on 21st of the 1st, 1989, and it was cracked by so-and-so. Greetings out to these groups. Something along those lines, with a graphical effect in the background and a bit of music. Essentially, these intros then formed into demos, which created the demo scene. So cracking groups, the coders of the cracking groups might have, I don't know whether they got bored of just cracking games or whether they felt their talent was better used somewhere else, but they split off to make demo scene groups. And in some cases, there would be divisions within one group, Fairlight for one, where always had a demo scene group and a cracking group, you know, different sides of the division doing different things. Whether they were in contact with each other, I don't know. Whether just two types of groups assumed the name and agreed that they would use the name, I'm not too sure how that worked. But there we go. Anyway, that was just my point about without the cracking scene, the demo scene may never have existed. It probably would. It's like anything. Evolution happens. But because of the cracking scene, the demo scene happened. Whether it happened anyway, we will never, ever know. So there's a little bit of history behind the cracking. Now I'm going to go in some of the downsides of cracking and downsides of piracy and maybe some of the upsides of piracy as well. Let's look at the first downside of piracy. You've got the companies, right? And did it kill them off? Did it affect their sales? Well, I mean, it's a no-brainer to say, of course it affected them, but did it affect them as much as what was reported in the media and what these companies might have said? I'm tempted to say I don't think it affected them quite like they said, but, you know, the more I think about it, of course it did. These are people's livelihoods, these are people's livings, and we're essentially stealing off them. Piracy is not a victimless crime, okay? Even with big corporate companies like EA, who have got massive profits, loads of shareholders, and whatever else, it's still affecting their bottom line, right? It's still affecting them. So I think it's wrong to say that they weren't affected by piracy. I think what was really evident was that as the Spectrum progressed and the Commodore 64 progressed, Amiga and ST progressed, when the piracy started hitting these companies, they could have survived with it, absolutely. But there is these other markets, you know, SNES Mega Drive, Master System, that was pretty much providing an environment with very, very little piracy, very high sales. Again, you're gonna go over there, aren't you? You're gonna go over there. So I don't think necessarily in all cases these companies died because of piracy. The grass was greener. If you're on the Amiga and you're developing a game and it costs, I don't know, 10 grand to develop as a rough figure of something, you know, a fairly small title, and you sell 20,000 units, yet you spend the same amount on a Master System game, but it sells 50,000 units, well, you're going to go over there, aren't you? You're going to pack up shop and go over there. And that's what happened with someone like Ultimate. They left the 8-bit world and went to the NES because the sales were so massive over there. Become Rare, and, well, we all know what happened to Rare. It's a massive company with massive titles. And Codemasters as well took a lot of their franchises over to the NES and various other consoles, and sold in droves, absolute droves. I think on the podcast that Andy did with the Oliver Brothers, they mentioned how when they started developing for the... I might have read it somewhere, I'm trying to think back of where I heard this, but they certainly mentioned that when they found the NES, when they'd been coding for the C64 for so long, they found the NES and how many sales they could make over on the NES. It was just, right, see you later, I'm off over there. And you can see why, because piracy hit companies to such a degree that they had to look elsewhere to earn the same kind of money again. But I also think that naturally formats come to an end, don't they? The Spectrum come to its natural end. The Commodore 64 come to its natural end. Then the 16-bit era. Every format comes to its end. All right. A lot of these formats are getting a, you know, second, third or fourth wind now, especially look at the Commodore 64. There's so many commercial games coming out for it again. I call it like the second wave of commercial, because that's what's happening now. You've got people publishing games again for these platforms. But back then, naturally, it came to the end of its life cycle because people had moved on to other formats. And then, again, they'd moved on to different formats after that. And because of the piracy as well, sales were really dipping down low. So that's when the format essentially died off and the company moved on to different avenues, or essentially closed themselves down because they didn't want to move or didn't see it viable to move. So companies were certainly affected, and in turn, I think it's probably the game developers that were more affected by the piracy, because publishers weren't so keen to sign up games for a particular platform because the piracy was so bad on that platform. And they might not have got their royalties from games because the games were pirated so much. So it's all a knock-on effect, isn't it? It's all a knock-on effect. Moving on to formats, though, did piracy kill off any formats? And this is, and I'm posing these as questions for you so you can have a think about it and disagree or agree with me. I don't think piracy killed off formats. I've just talked about how formats come to a natural end. Piracy didn't kill off formats. I think, in essence, piracy actually promoted a lot of formats. Because, let's go back into the school playground. You're there with your mate Johnny, and he's got a Commodore 64, and he can copy you 20 games tomorrow if you bought yourself, or you got your mum and dad to buy you a Commodore 64. But old... Steve over there in the corner, he's got a NES, and he's got two games for his NES. Got one for his birthday and one for Christmas. And he's not getting another one until he's got himself a paper round or another birthday comes up, right? So he's going to end up with three games, possibly four if he gets himself a little job. You'll think, hold on a minute, so I can get 20 games off my mate Johnny, but mate, you have just forgotten his name off over there. He's only got a couple of games for his NES. Well, I'm going to get a Commodore 64, aren't I? There's Mario over on the NES, but I can get something similar on the Commodore 64. And I think that's what drove a lot of sales, actually, into the home computers, was because piracy was so rife, you could get games so damn easily for it. And the games were cheaper if you wanted to buy. You didn't really get the big budget titles over on the consoles. You couldn't buy a $1.99 game for your NES or your Master System, could you? Spectrum, Commodore 64, pop down, even your local news agency, you could buy yourself a Mastertronic game. Wow, that's just fantastic. or when Codemasters started releasing Advanced Ski Simulator or Advanced Skateboard Simulator. $2.99, thank you very much, I love that. So while I think piracy certainly fueled sales of formats, there is no way piracy killed off formats, because again, it's this natural evolution, because people move on. People say that the Amiga got killed off at the end because of, well, as a contributing factor, as piracy. I don't think so. I think Commodore's absolutely lack of ability in ruining the platform probably killed off the Amiga more than anything. Commodore UK were doing really, really well in 94, and actually the profitable arm of Commodore, if they'd have actually ended up buying out the company, I think the Amiga would have survived another few years, definitely. I don't think piracy killed off the Amiga. I think it drew, like I said, a lot of publishers, they pushed away from it because they weren't making quite the money. But again, people were moving on. People were moving to the SNES or even into the PlayStation by that point, and PC gaming. So I think it was a natural tail off of the Amiga that killed off the Amiga, really. And, you know, if we're going to be pedantic about it, it hasn't been killed off. It never killed off. It still exists, really. It still exists in all our minds. It's just not commercially available. All right, you can buy something that's got an Amiga label on it now, but it's not actually commercially available anymore. But you know where I'm coming from on this. It's platforms naturally evolve and naturally die off. And I think that's what kills platforms more than piracy. It's just the natural evolution of moving on to the next best thing. And that's it, really. So definitely companies were massively affected by piracy. You can't say otherwise. Game developers who develop those games for the companies affected, really. That sums up how affected the industry was. But what was good about piracy? There is good things about piracy. Obviously, we all want a freebie. You get free games, and you can get free music nowadays really, really easy. Spotify, for one thing, is a place where you get free music. Artists earn sod all off Spotify. So in my opinion, even though I'm a user of Spotify, it's tantamount to piracy, because the artists are not earning anything off of it. You know, the music world is changing to accommodate this type of music listening now anyway. So it's very, very hard to make money in music, but when you make money, you can shed loads of money through gigs, merchandise, and so on. The games world has had to change in a very different way to it. But yeah, what is good about piracy? So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to argue here, because I argue a lot on my podcast, so I always use that as a little starter. We would not have the retro gaming culture that we have now if it wasn't for piracy. Why? Because me, just take me as a prime example, I wouldn't have played half the games that I did, or have half the games that I did, without piracy, yeah? And I might not have continued my interest in computers, or in consoles, or in programming computers, or making musical computers. I might not have had that interest because the games weren't there for me. But because I could get games through pirated means, because I could get games for nothing, essentially, it kept my interest in that platform. It kept me working on that platform for many, many years. I was using my Amiga as my sole computer right up until 2000, I think, when I built myself a PC. I'm sure it was 2000, 2001 even. I was making music on it up until I was playing games on it, and still getting games on it, and that says it all, really. I stuck with it because I loved it so much. And the games were a big part of that. They kept me loving that platform. And I think it's the same for a lot of us. You stuck with a platform if you could get pirated games a lot longer than if you couldn't get pirated games, I believe, anyway. And when games started coming down in price, obviously, and there was budget ranges, that all obviously helped you. But I think, certainly with the home computers, without piracy, retro gaming culture wouldn't be as big as what they are now. And I actually bought games off the back of piracy. I've bought music off the back of piracy as well. I might have downloaded an album. I might have got a copy of a game, which in turn I thought, I love that game. Might not have bought that one, but I'd have gone on to buy another game by that same developer or by the same publisher because I loved it so much. Or you've gone to trade shows. I remember the ECTS and the Amiga shows in the 90s, where publishers and so on would sell their games really, really cheaply there. So I'd buy the games that I might have had a pirate copy of, for instance. So some good comes off the back of Pirates, not always though. But I still don't think we would have the retro gaming culture that we have now without piracy. And you could look at that from an emulation point of view as well. Emulation being a bit of a grey area still, unless companies who own the IP to particular games or individuals that own the IPs to particular games, they give permission for their games to be distributed around as ROM files. But it's essentially piracy, isn't it? And we wouldn't be able to play those games now. Or we wouldn't be able to experience some of the games that, I don't know, might sell for 100 quid on eBay, because I'm not going to go out and spend 100 quid on a game on eBay. So I'm missing out on that game. But with the power of emulation, essentially, you could say piracy, I can experience that game and experience what a wonderful game it might be, or what a crap game it is, either way. So piracy has benefited, I think, the gaming world as individuals, not as the companies or the publishers or the format. As an individual, it brings better things to you. And I suppose you could say that because you've stayed with that platform longer, because pirate games have kept you interested in that platform, you've gone out and bought more games as well. Unless you're, like I said earlier, I don't think I know anyone who didn't ever buy a game. So I think piracy would have kept you with that platform, and it meant you would have bought games as well. Because sometimes you couldn't get the games you really wanted, so you had to go out and buy them. It's tit for tat, isn't it, really, in that one. So that's one of the better sides of piracy, along with the progression into the demo scene. I think that had a great... That come out of piracy in many ways, shapes and forms. And for me, being a demo scene lover, I think that's a massive benefit to have come out of the back of piracy. But don't think I'm condoning piracy. I'm really not condoning it. I'm just saying there is some good that comes out of the back of piracy, definitely. So, obviously, when you got a pirate game, some of the problems with having pirate games, sometimes it didn't work properly. So they'd been either cracked in such a way that they weren't cracked that well, therefore they didn't work all the way to the end. You didn't get a manual. I know some Commodore 64 games had a manual built on the disc, but I don't ever recall an Amiga game having a manual on it. So you had to guess how to play these games. And in some cases, you would never be able to. And then you might end up going out and buying it because you've seen great reviews. I mean, you've got to look at something like Elite 2 Frontier. God, without a manual there, you'd be stuffed, I think. Absolutely stuffed. Of course, there's playing guides that come out for some games that you could buy in game shops and in magazine shops. They kind of overruled the manuals a little bit, so you could deem that piracy was still okay because you could get a gaming guide on it. You didn't get a lovely box, nice bit of artwork. Sometimes you'd have a poster inside, pin up on your wall. All these little extras that come with it. In the early days of Psygnosis, you'd get a T-shirt maybe in the box. Certainly a lovely bit of artwork, and you'd never get that with a pirate game. Some people obviously don't care about having that tangible product, but I think most of us who are still sitting here now and listening to this podcast and doing this podcast and into retro gaming, you've got enough interest in it to love having a tangible product. I don't have that many original games these days because it's just through space limitations, but I love it when I get it. You know, I ordered a new Commodore 64 game about a year and a half ago called Solus through Cytronic software. And to get a brand new Commodore 64 game that had just been released in a beautiful box with a lovely art, but it had a great bit of art with it, which is on the flip side was the map of the game. It really was a fantastic experience because I like having a tangible product. I'm all for digital because it's nice and small, it's compact. You can lose it very easy, which isn't a good thing. But, you know, I was a vinyl collector. I was a computer game collector to some degree. I love that tangible product. I love having something in my hands. So you never got that as a pirate. But like I say, everyone who's probably still into retro gaming in some way has some kind of original game in their collection, because it's nice to have that physical product from time to time, definitely. Certainly of the must-have games, games that mean a lot to you. If I look at my Amiga collection now, I've got things like Putty and Iridium 2 because I simply love those games. They are great games with lovely boxes as well and a bit of artwork inside. Obviously, another problem with pirate games, you're not supporting the companies. You're not supporting game development going forward. So that's a key point there. And I think gaming's changed so much over the years now, where it got to a point before things like mobile gaming got big with the app stores and that kind of thing, got to a point where big franchises ruled the roost, and that was pretty much it. Whereas now you've seen a turnaround where indie games have become really popular now because of these means of digital distribution, and then you've got the iOS app store, you've got the Android Play or whatever it's called. These digital means of distribution is bringing back the indie game developer, bringing back the small developer, which is great. Someone like Team 17 come back on the 360 with Alien Breed Evolution. Nice game, running on the Unreal Engine, so it's probably fairly cheap to develop, and a digital way of distributing it. Great, you know, that their overheads are so small on that that it's made this company once again thrive. And that's probably happening with a lot of companies. And you only got to take one small indie game that suddenly goes viral. Angry Birds is key to that argument. And that company's made its millions. So, you know, while you know, again, you're starting to be able to support companies because piracy isn't such a problem now. Okay, you can jailbreak your phones, you can get free games quite easily, but they're so damn cheap now that you don't really want to do it. I remember when I first jailbroke my iPhone, I started downloading games, and I felt really guilty, actually, because I was downloading games of smaller developers, not the big games. So I've got real no interest in those big games, to be honest with you. I've always liked the underdog. And I deleted all those games, and I bought the majority of them. Or if I didn't buy it, I didn't have it anymore, because I felt guilty. I felt absolutely guilty, and I didn't think it was right that I was doing that. My conscience got the better of me for once in my life, I think we could say that. So there's a lot of problem with piracy, not just around not having a box and manual and the instructions, but you're not supporting the industry. And I don't think you could ever put a figure on how piracy has affected the industry. It clearly has, there's no doubt about it, but how much game development has been lost? How many game developers have been lost? How many publishing companies have been lost due to piracy? You couldn't put a figure on it. You couldn't put a figure on it. When a big conglomerate publisher goes under, they will blame piracy just as a matter of course. They won't blame some incompetences in middle management at all. They'll blame piracy because it's nice and easy to blame. But it's not solely the reason these companies go under. But I think that's a whole big subject that I can't really quantify, and I'm not going to go into too much right now. Piracy is still rife nowadays. You've got, right from the PS1 up to the present day, you've got this thing, this concept of mod chips, where you would either solder a chip in or be some kind of soft modification you could do through an exploit in a game. I think that's on the original Xbox. I was going to say the Xbox One then, but that's obviously the new Xbox, which is stupidly confusing. The original Xbox, you can do a soft mod through one of the Tom Clancy games, I think, which allows you to install either crack games or things like emulators as well. So mod chips isn't always about piracy. It could be about emulation, which in itself is a form of piracy if you think about it that way. But so mod chips, I've got a chipped GameCube. Fantastic, love it. I've got a SNES emulator on it. Brilliant, love it. I've got some copied games. I'll freely admit that, actually. I remember swapping that with someone for an Amiga 1200. There's another Amiga 1200 I had. GameCube chips come up, bosh, I've got it, it's brilliant, love it, just for that SNES emulator more than anything, absolutely brilliant. But because games are getting harder and harder to get hold of in some cases or whatever, I could download the ISO off the internet and burn it to the small CDs that the GameCube uses, and because it's chipped, it'll work. But essentially GameCube games at the moment are fairly reasonable on eBay and Amazon, so I'm quite happy to buy them if I need them. But yeah, chipping goes on, and right from the PS1, the GameCube had, the Xbox got, Xbox 360. The way that the industry has responded with the 360 and the PS3 is, I'm sure it happened on the PS3, certainly on the 360, was Microsoft started banning 360s that went online, went on to Xbox Live and checked in, and they could see that it was a cracked, modded console, and banned it from being online. So it couldn't stop the console from working. I'm sure that might come in at some point. I'm sure it's probably very possible now. But banned it from playing online gaming. So you can still play it offline, fine, but you couldn't play it online. So piracy is still around nowadays. I don't think it's probably quite as much of a problem as it was. This is quite specialist because of this mod chip factor. the Dreamcast was probably the last console with really bad piracy, because you could essentially copy games relatively easy on that, and use what was there was a Utopia boot disc that allowed you to play copied games on the Dreamcast. Really, really easy to do. Didn't require any hardware modifications. So it's still around nowadays. Now, another benefit to piracy is something that comes about with archiving. So over the years, all these ROM sites have popped up on the internet for every single platform right across the board. And without these games being cracked or some way, you know, the ROMs dumped from, you know, illegally dumped off their actual, the original cartridge, we wouldn't have all these ROMs digitally archived now to play. And it's acting as some kind of vault, basically. You know, all these sites like Planet Emu, Cool ROMs, all those kind of sites, which we do not condone here at Retro Asylum, of course, they're all acting as a digital archive of all these games. You just go onto one of these sites, and you could, if you're so inclined, download an Amiga game. And you bet your bottom dollar that it's a cracked Amiga game, and it's on there, and that's the reason it's been able to be archived, because it's cracked, it's had the copy protection removed, thus archiving it for a future generation to play these games. That's one positive thing you can look at piracy. One big positive, actually, is the fact that you could dump these ROMs or remove the copy protection, and they live on forever. Again, I know I keep using the Amiga as an example, because obviously Amiga is the platform that I'm most in love with. Blimey, that's a deep in love. There's this program called WHD Load, which allows you to hard disk install loads of Amiga games. A lot of Amiga games didn't come with hard drive installers. So this WHD Load, which has come about in the last, I don't know when it was first released, maybe 97, 98, but still being developed and updated now. And you can still register it and get it. And it's become quite common now because of these compact flash SD card style solutions that you can get for current computers. But taking the Amiga as an example, WHD Load has taken games that aren't hard drive installable to make them hard drive installable. And by doing that, you're essentially ripping out the copy protection off the original game. And there's people like there's old crackers that are still doing it now, just to make these games hard drive installable. And in some cases, improving them. There might be a game that didn't work on the Amiga 1200, has been made to work. And that was another benefit with pirated games as well, is a lot of times there'll be trainers put on them so you could cheat, so you'd have infinite lives, infinite energy, no enemies, level skip, that kind of thing. So they improved the game to some degrees, or fixed them for, you take the Amiga game for example, a game that's on the A500 that didn't work on the 1200. Crackers might have released a version that did work on the 1200. They fixed games, as well as added trainers to them. I was never a big cheat kind of person. I might use the odd level skip, but so I was never interested in those trainers. I was more interested in the intros. I loved intros and loved the music on intros. But again, that's just another example of good things from piracy. But I think to really bring this podcast to a close, piracy is obviously bad. You're stealing. You are stealing. It's not good. It's not good for any industry to do it. But I think we can all say we all do it. You could probably look at the music industry more than the gaming industry, as it's almost accepted that piracy is what happens now. I bet you all the kids out there on the streets now, I say kids as if I'm really old, I'm not really old, but you know, you're 16, even younger, 14, 15, 16 year olds with their iPods on, with their Dre Beats headphones or knockoffs from eBay trying to look cool on the streets, they haven't bought their music. You can bet your bottom dollar the majority of the music on their iPods or iPhones or whatever player they've got is pirated. And I think the music industry is really have to accept that. That's it. Until they come up with a model that is better than the current model of making music, selling it online, selling it as CDs, it's going to be the case. With gaming, I mean, you've had the recent announcement, the Xbox One, which was going to have some kind of DR, digital rights management, into it to stop piracy. I think they've subsequently removed that when it got slated so hard by the industry itself. But there's things going on to try and stop or prevent or limit piracy in some way. You'll never get rid of it. It's just cat and mouse, isn't it? It's cat and mouse, like cops and robbers. You're never going to wipe it out completely, I don't think. And it's just something we've got to live with, and it's something that all industries have to work around, because it's always going to be here. Where there is stuff to buy, there's going to be ways to get it for free, and that can happen for physical products like, I don't know, Gillette shavers, shaving blades. If you live in certain parts of the country, you can get them for free, nice and easy, down the pub, or cheaper than in the shops, because they've been nicked. It's the same with games. You're going to be able to get them pirated in some way, shape or form. It doesn't take long for the pirates to catch up. And the pirates love the challenge. That's the whole thing with piracy. It's such an elite world. It's an elite world where people want to impress. And these crackers, they want to get the stuff out as quickly as possible, crack it as quickly as possible, and show they're the best. And I think each new generation of machine with its new kind of copy protections on it just poses another challenge for a would-be pirate, should we say. And just to show how keen crackers are to impress and try and be the best out there, I've read stories previously of crackers going to trade shows, getting into trade shows somehow, and nicking cartridges, nicking development games from the publisher's stands, getting them home, cracking them, releasing them that day. Just because they could do that and they could show that they were the best. They would release them. You know, there's another point of that which I haven't really covered here, is how did the crackers get their wares out onto the streets? Well, just quickly, bulletin boards, Google that. It's an early form of internet, should you say. Great places, loved them, they were really good. Or mail swappers, you know, people literally spreading them through the mail system. But there we go. Anyway, I'm wrapping this up now, trying to bring this to an end. Piracy, obviously very bad, but it's had its benefits to us over the years, and I think it will continue to do just that in many ways, shapes or forms. The industries need to work out a way of better serving us as consumers to stop us pirating the games. It really is. It's as simple as that in theory, obviously very, very hard to do. I hope you enjoyed that sort of roundup on piracy. I'd like to give a shout out to Soulstar, who did a audition recently. He spoke a little bit about piracy. I was very much thinking of doing a piracy podcast, and that part of his podcast really spurred me on. So shout out to you, sir. Coming on to now, Retromania, just to talk about August the 25th, Sunday, August 25th. It is a bank holiday Sunday. So that means there's no school or work the next day for a lot of us, of course. And we, Retro Asylum, Andy, is putting on an event down there in the Wickford Community Centre in Essex. It's going to be a nice, intimate little affair. Lots of systems on show. There's a great guy who joined up with the forum. He's offered out loads and loads of consoles and systems. But we're going to have, the usual suspects: NES, Mega Drive, Amiga, SNES. But there's more off-key stuff like the 3DO, and I think there's a Philips video pack there. About 40 systems, 40 to 50 systems in total being on show here. So that's August 25th, Wickford Community Centre in Essex. Haven't got the postcode on me at the moment, so I can't give you that. But if you go onto the Retro Asylum website, you can find everything about it there. Damien from this very podcast is doing a little hardware repair session. He's not necessarily going to repair your consoles and your computers on site, but he'll give you a little sort of tutorial on how to do it. It's not really the best sort of environment to start repairing stuff there. I'm still considering doing a little how-to on music making on the Amiga, possibly the Commodore 64, but due to my recent move, that might all filter out. But there's also games competitions going on. So there'll be games competitions on things like Micro Machines, Sensible Soccer, Street Fighter, and they're going to run throughout the day. So this event, which runs from 10 till 6 p.m, like I said, Wickford Community Centre down there in Wickford, Essex, I think it's going to be a nice little event. Like I say, it's a nice, intimate affair, not too big. Hopefully you know, a nice amount of people so we can all get on, have a chat with each other, play some games. I think it's going to be fantastic. I'm certainly going to be there. Andy, putting it on, going to do a marvellous job on the day. He'll be there. A lot of the rest of the Retro Asylum crew are going to be there, and a lot of the listeners and forum members are going to be there. So get yourself over to the website, www.retroasylum.com. Sign up, have a look what's going on, and leave some comments about this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I've enjoyed talking about piracy, and hope you enjoy the rest of the week's podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Denaris. I'm out of here. See you later. And just to say, just before I go, the tune you hear in the background right now is a tune of mine, which I did on the Amiga in 1994, I think it was. This has just been released by a label called Omni Music, and I'm so chuffed to have an old Amiga tune been released. The compilation it's on is called Omni Retro. It's all about old sounding tunes, and well, clearly this is an old tune done on the Amiga. Fantastic, it's come out. The compilation's also got another tune by myself on there called Helectro, which is an electro tune, plain and simple. That wasn't done on the Amiga, that was done on a more modern package called Reason. If you get over to Bandcamp, so it's omnimusic.bandcamp.com, I believe. So that's Omni, O-M-N-I, music.bandcamp.com. There's also another couple of releases out on that label of mine, a couple of more releases of mine on there, on that label. One on the Sanctuary EP, which was released a couple of months ago. And if you look back on a couple of other compilations, you will find a few more tracks by myself. So check that out. I think you might enjoy it.